finishing our part, our study of the theoretical and theological view of marriage, we come now, it's interesting we got guests today because this is the most controversial part of the syllabus that is controversial in the modern church. You know, there are three subjects about which a preacher can speak today, at least three, and know he's in trouble, no matter who he's speaking to or what he says. One is prophecy. The other is the Holy Spirit. The other place is the role of women. I mean, it doesn't matter what you say. And I end up teaching all three. God, in His infinite mercy and His love for me, has worked it out so that all three of these subjects are my responsibility here at the college. I'm going to take that up, God, one day when I get to the other side. Why He has so honored me, I do not know. Now, we're looking at the first statement is in our syllabus, page 20. That marriage calls for Christ-like love and concern. The Christian marriage must not be simply a matter of warm philia. We've studied our friendship, or passionate eros, romantic love, but rather a relationship steeped in agape, the sacrificial, gracious love best manifested in Christ. Ephesians 5:22 says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church." Now, well, let's look at the Ephesian text, which we want to not just refer to it. We're talking about the New Testament theology of the marriage. Well, this is it, brother. It starts out in verse 22. Now you get the controversial part. Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. This is my amen table over here. They all like that verse. I know men in the church who, if they dropped their Bible in a windstorm, it would fall open to Ephesians 5:22. In fact, I know a couple of guys, a couple of deacons, the only two verses in the Bible they know three. John 3:16, Ephesians 5:22, and Jesus wept. They don't know where that is, but they know that. They know that verse. Actually, it says in the Greek, "Wives, to your husbands as to the Lord, be to your husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife." Now, it's based upon the statement in verse 21, "and subject to one another in the fear of Christ." Wives, to your husbands, implied subject to your husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, He Himself being the Savior of the body. Now, but as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for her, that He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the Word, that He might present to Himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So, husbands, that is, the Greek word means in this way, in the same way, husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. And then he quotes the Genesis 2:24 text that we've looked at so much. Man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. That is, that's my subject. I'm talking about Christ and the church. Nevertheless, he says, while we're on the subject, let's not forget the analogy, and that is, let each individual among you also love his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see to it that she respect her husband. You understand? He gives this extended analogy. His main topic is the relationship, the subjection of the church to Christ, the head of the church. But he says that it is also important for us to remember that husbands are to love your wives, wives are to be in subjection to your husbands. Now, let me say a word that this is not in your syllabus, and this is for I need to know. This concept, and we haven't discussed it yet, but this concept is under attack today. I don't mean by the secularists. They think this is old. Their word for this is medieval. And they're the people, you know, who test ideas by dating them. But it's under attack also by professors in colleges and seminaries, they practice liberal is the word I want, at least in some things. And what they do is they practice the method of hermeneutics called contextualizing, which is a legitimate hermeneutic taken wrong. What they do is they go through the scriptures, and anything they don't like, they say, well, that was cultural. That was tied to the first century culture, and it's not binding today. And that is a legitimate hermeneutic. That is, there are some things which we recognize that are clearly cultural. For instance, the holy kiss. It was a custom of the day. And so what we do with the holy kiss, greet one another with a holy kiss. What we do is we understand the principle and we shake hands. And so that is but they take it too far, and almost in all error, of course, is truth taken too far. They say, well, that was cultural, and it's not binding today if they don't like it. And this is one thing they don't like very well at all. You can read some manuscripts that have come out of the North American recently and as examples of this kind of a pseudo-scholarship. Standard Publishing, some years ago, published a Festschrift to Dean Walker, in which Scott Barchi attacks this doctrine. And what they try to say is that he takes the approach that some scriptures are normative and some are cultural. Of course, he decides which are which. He says the normative text is the Galatian text. There's neither male nor female. They're all one in Christ Jesus. That's the normative doctrine. That means that that nobody is subjection. We're all equal. That nobody is in subjection to anybody. The text like this one, a text that says, for example, that a woman is not supposed to preach, that's not normative, that's cultural. And they try to attack this text as being cultural. You understand that in the first century, the husbands were the head of the house, but in this sense, we're not bound by that because that's cultural. You understand that? But they can't just leave it at that because there's too much said about it in the New Testament. So they have to attack it. They have to attack it exegetically. And what he tries to say in this, in his approach, and others join them. This is the common approach: is that when it says Christ, that the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. That we should not understand it head in the sense of authority. It is head in the sense of source. The husband is the source of the wife, as Christ is the source of the church. That's what they say. You should translate head, kephale is the Greek word, source. Now, I'm not going to get into that except to say that it's absurd. First place, a husband is not the source of his wife. That doesn't make any sense. And they've got some other defects into it, which I'm not going to get into in this course. It's not, of course, in the Pauline epistles. But the problem they have is if all they had was the word source, I'm sorry, the word head, they could play games with it, as they try to do. But you see, that's not the only word. You also have the word subjection. And subjection means subjection. You understand? Even if we say the husband is the source of the wife, it still says wives be in subjection to your husbands. But the first argument is silly. Let me just add an editorial comment on that kind. That kind of exegesis, these preachers, these scholars, who so-called scholars, who offer this, in my opinion, strictly an opinion, they didn't get this in the study. They got this in the bedroom. I think they got the word from their wives. That is, there was some fear and trembling behind, underlying that exegesis, but it wasn't fear of God. Now, I may be wrong about that, but I'm not. I call this, it's so ridiculous, hermeneutically speaking, by men with PhDs who are doing it, I call it henpecked hermeneutics. You can tell them I said that. Okay, so let's be very clear. Does the Bible teach this? Yes, but that doesn't mean it's well understood. How, I ask, as we continue through the syllabus, is this subjection of the wife to her husband to be reconciled with Galatians 3:28, which teaches that they're neither male nor female? And I've already mentioned what I've discussed here. Well, let me just approach it this way. Look what I put in. Let me read with you this statement I put in capital letters. If a husband is to his wife what Christ is to the church, and the wife is to her husband what the church is to Christ, there is no problem in the matter of subjection. I'm going to say the last. If not, no other arrangement will help. That is, many men, Christian men, because of ignorance and arrogance, or any combination thereof, many Christian men make their wives miserable and ruin their homes. They foul their own nest. They destroy their own kingdom by reading this text to say, well, what this means is I'm the boss, that and nothing else. That is, they see that word authority, and that's the, or they see the concept of authority, and that's the only thing they see, and they make it very difficult for their wives. I have a very close friend who does this to his wife. And he has created a lot of misery. Many Christian men make it very difficult for their wives to obey Christ because of the way they treat them. You see, now look what the text says. The husband is the head of the wife as, in the same way that Christ is the head of the church. Now my principle I teach is this. Let me read this. I put it in capital letters. If the husband is to his wife what Christ is to the church, and the wife is to her husband what the church is to Christ, there is no problem in the matter of subjection. See, the problem in the matter of subjection of the wife comes in if a man is not to his wife, he's over his wife, but he's not over his wife in the way that Christ is over the church. However, and the marriage suffers. However, I point out that no other arrangement will make it a better marriage. Now, matter of subjection, authority in the home. Now, let me first of all say the Bible teaches authority in the home, and it belongs to the man if there is a husband. First point. Now, this is a strange doctrine today. It's considered old-fashioned. I can remember when I was in the 50s, I grew up in a Midwestern farm community, and about every home had a dad, and every dad I knew was the head of his house. We walked in fear of our fathers, a moderate fear, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think about that much terror is a very efficient substance or element in running a house, so it saves a lot of time. The education system worked fine because all the teachers had to say was, look, you guys straighten up or I'll tell your dad. And that created instant order for a long time. All my friends had the same real idea. You get a spanking at school, you get one at home. It's automatic. I tried to explain to my father one time how the teacher didn't understand me. And I found out right away that he didn't care if the teacher understood me. What he cared about was, did I understand him? And the second time around I did. I understood, yes sir. When he got through with that sassafras stick, I said to him, nobody ever explained it to me that way before. Not really. Well then I began my ministry in the 60s. In the 60s that was the freedom generation, the hippie days. And in America, including the church, in many, many homes, the women took over as the head of the house. The men didn't want it anymore, and they gave it to the women. In the 70s, the women gave it to the kids. Now we have homes run by 8-year-old kids, and I'm not making that up. I'm in homes. I was in a home in Florida 2 years ago run by a dog. I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you. See, if in a situation like a home, you have two wills, one will is this and one will is this, whichever will wins out, that's who's the head of the house.
And this couple had retired, they had a motor home, and they took an early retirement so they could travel, and they found out after he retired that their dog didn't like to travel, a little poodle. And they sat there, and they sat there for a year and a half when I was in their home. He's an elder in the church now. A year and a half, and watched that motor home rust in the driveway because Fifi didn't like, or whatever that dog's name was, didn't like to travel. And I almost, wow, I'll tell you, it was one of the hardest things I ever had to keep a straight face. I thought, man, take that dog in the front yard, drop kick Fifi. I mean, I have seen weak-mindedness in my day, but that's about, I mean, the only place he had to go was if he would be intimidated by his goldfish. Other than that, I wouldn't know where else he could. Now, however, and so this is a strange doctrine, but let me teach you the important thing here. The operative word, men, in the biblical doctrine of authority, the operative word in the biblical doctrine, as I understand it, especially in Ephesians 5, where we have the most complete explanation of it in the New Testament, what we've just read, the operative word is not the word authority in this doctrine of the husband is the head of the wife. The operative word, I write this down, men, put it in capital letters and write it in color. If you forget it, I may come to haunt you after I'm dead. The operative word is not the word authority. The operative word is the word responsibility. The biblical doctrine is that the husband is responsible for the home. On what basis do I say that? I say it on the basis of the fact that what Paul actually said was that the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. How did Christ get to be the head of the church? He got to be the head of the church by taking the ultimate responsibility for the life of the church in that he died for the church. Jesus became the head of the church on the cross, which is exactly where a man becomes the head of the house. And if he tries to become the head of the house anywhere but on the cross, then he's going to hurt his marriage. You see, it was not simply a matter of declaring authority. You got that? Look what the text says. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Got that phrase? And gave himself up for her. And the problem comes when a man says, I am the head of the house, I'm the head of my wife, and he will not give himself up for her. And not very many women have any trouble being in subjection to a man who gives himself up for her. Now, you see, the doctrine is, first of all, we have the authority because we have the responsibility. That is, we have the authority, men, whether we want it or not, in order that we might meet our responsibilities. Now, the man who claims the authority, and this happens regularly, a man who claims the authority without taking the responsibility will damage or ruin his home. It's easy to take the authority. All you got to do is be big and mean and loudmouth and threatening. But see, an animal can do that. But you see, the man who takes the authority without taking the responsibility is going to have to answer to God. Now, the responsibility is ours. What I teach is this, that if the home doesn't work, fellas, if your home doesn't work, God is not going to ask your wife why it didn't work. He's going to ask you. You are responsible. Not that we do everything, but you are responsible. Understand? If my kids turn out to be a bunch of rotten brats, I don't care what my wife, which is a distinct impossibility, right, Leslie? if my daughters or my sons turn out to be obnoxious snots that nobody can stand, I do not care what my wife has done or not done, God is going to hold me responsible. If I understand this biblical principle, just like in the church, if the local church doesn't work, God is not going to ask the Ladies Christian Fellowship why the church didn't work. Regardless of what they did or did not do, he's going to hold the elders responsible. Why? They have the authority so they can meet their responsibility. Now, the reason that men in the 60s gave it over to the women, in the 70s the women gave it to the children, is nobody wants the responsibility. This is the part of this cultural malaise we're in, that nobody wants the responsibility. Men want to get married, they want a home, but they do not want to take the responsibility for it, so they give it to their wife. And wives get tired of it, and they just quit. And the kids, I'll tell you one thing, the kids don't want it. They don't want that responsibility. We are responsible, you understand? Now, that what does that mean? That means that I become, to repeat myself, I become the head of my house on a cross. Now, fellas, that's what the text says. That's a long way from being just a boss. And I teach this. Now, there are some women who were raised in the problem comes, I mentioned yesterday, we have women who were raised in functioning matriarchies who don't know how to let a man be the head of the house. We got men now who are young boys, the majority in your generation were raised in functioning matriarchies who don't know how to be the head of the house, and it doesn't work because they don't know how. They've been intimidated. They've been told, well, if you take over, then you're just an old-fashioned pervert or or some kind of weird throwback to an earlier period. And we have some women who are not going to be in subjection to any man, no matter who it is. Some women are going to run things or ruin them. They get up every morning and run for the pants of the family, and if somebody's already in them, just ruins their whole day. and they're just not going to do it, no matter what. Some women are like that. And if you're like that, ladies, stay single. Listen, you do not have to be in subjection to a husband. All you have to do is stay single. But once you get married, you are responsible to God to be in subjection to your husband. But hear me, the primary responsibility is his. He is responsible to make it possible for you to do that. And I'm going to say now, it's very important. I teach this, that in a home where this matter of headship and subjection, to use the language of Paul, is properly carried out, the issue almost never comes up. If it's a continuing issue in the home, something is fundamentally wrong. The man that has to get up every morning and remind his wife that he's the head of the house, he isn't. Somebody's kidding somebody. You understand? If he has to keep bossing her around and saying, now, don't forget what the Bible says, every morning he has to read Ephesians 5:22 to his wife, with her morning coffee, then he had, I'm caricaturing that, but not a whole lot, then he has failed. You got that? And a man who has to threaten his wife and intimidate her, and certainly a man who would use physical abuse on his wife, he has more than failed. Understand? But a man who has to bully and threaten and intimidate and be cruel to his wife, he's a little boy who just doesn't know how to make it work. Now, my wife and I team teach this sometimes. If she were here, I think she would agree. Most women do not want to be the head of the house. Most women don't want that responsibility. And it's not a matter of putting women down. That's this transcendent masculinity and femininity I'm talking about. I'll tell you, here's what I mean. I'm not talking about, now there's, every family has its own chemistry. And we're going to talk about these particulars as we go along through the syllabus. Every family has its own chemistry. And the different roles they play. For instance, who keeps the checkbook? That has nothing to do with who's the head of the house. That's just a matter of choices. And who does certain things? I know men, some of the most masculine men I know, regularly cook and wash the dishes. They like to do it. It had nothing to do with whether they're the head of the house or not. My wife doesn't want me in the kitchen.
And we agree on that. My wife and I agree. One of the decisions, the fundamental decision we had done more for our marriage than any other decision was that I don't take her fishing and she doesn't take me shopping. That has created worlds of harmony. And she doesn't want me doing certain things. But on the other hand, there are certain things that she's not, or my job, certain things are. But it's different in different families. You cannot drop a category and say, well, the man does these six things, he's the head of the house, and if he doesn't, he's not. That's silly. No, we're talking about. We're talking about who bears the ultimate responsibility. Let me teach you this. You see, in every family, eventually things are going to fall apart. That is, something's going to happen. I don't mean the whole thing necessarily, but something's going to happen that's a genuine emergency, where something has to be done. It can be a financial emergency. It can be an emergency with an injured child or a sick child. It can be an emergency that involves the house itself. It can involve any number of things. And when the emergency comes, who has to step in and put things back together to make it work? And I know in many homes, the man of the house is a big, blustering, masculine type fella, comic book kind of masculinity. But when things really get tough, the wife, his wife, has to step in and make things work. Why? Because she has to take the ultimate responsibility, because he can't for a moment. And a woman, and women do not want to do that. If things really get bad, they want to say, here, you take it. They really do, most women. Seriously, my wife is an interesting person. If I'm not, I travel a lot. If I'm not there and an emergency comes up, she handles it very well. She's an extremely intelligent woman, very competent. She doesn't like it, but she does it. But if I'm around, she just screams and hollers for me. And she loves it. I'm serious. A kid, you know, if I'm around, I'm there and the kid gets hurt, you know, she just really, come and take care of this. You know, but if I'm not there, she takes care of it very well. Interesting phenomena. Now, responsibility. And this is a Bible college, and we are training a leadership ministry for the church. And I'm of the opinion that one of the most important principles we've got to restore while we're restoring New Testament Christianity is because we're fighting our culture, and we live in a disintegrating culture, we have got to restore in the church the idea of the responsibility, not only of elders in the church, but the responsibility of men in their homes. Because no church is going to be any stronger than the homes anymore. And no home is going to be any stronger than its leadership. They're responsible. Now, the command for wives to submit to their husband is based on a redemptive relationship and the creative order. It's like 1 Timothy 2 and so forth. That is, let's look at 1 Timothy 2, 11 through 15. Let a woman quietly receive instruction. This is the, Laurie, this is the text that we, you know, your problem text came up. I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, then Eve, and it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman who being deceived fell into transgression. Now, it does not imply, hear me, it does not imply subjection or inferiority of the nature that will hinder the full development of either husband or wife. Let me teach you this. Freedom, there's no such thing. Women today want to be free. Well, men want to be free. Everybody wants to be free. But there's no such thing. Let me teach you the principle now. Listen very close. This is the abstract, but this is what you pay your tuition for to get this stuff. Tune in. There is no such thing as absolute freedom. Even God is not absolutely free. God is bound by reality. And this reality includes the reality of his own nature. All kinds of things God can't do. He's bound. He's the God of reality. Understand? Notice this. God is not free to make 2 and 2 equal 5. God cannot do it. He cannot, you understand? Because that's beyond the reality. Now, he can take 2 of anything you give him and make it into 2 of anything else. But if he gets 2 more of it, he's only got 4. Bound, and he's bound morally. The Bible says God cannot lie. He's bound. He's not perfectly free. Man is not perfectly free.
There's no such thing as absolute freedom. Why? We are bound by two things. Number one, we are bound by our will. We, as Romans 6 says, we are the slave of the one we choose to obey. And we're bound by our character, by our constitution. I mean, we're bound by what we are, what a reality. So that, you see, the problem today is not that women don't want to keep their place. I hear men say that. That's the problem in the world today, is women don't want to keep their place. That's not the problem. The problem is nobody wants to keep their place. See, and the reason women have trouble being in subjection to men is that they have husbands who don't want to be in subjection to anybody. A woman can be in subjection to her man if her man is in subjection to God. That's the problem, and his is the primary responsibility. Now, if there is such a thing as transcendent femininity, as we've already discussed, are y'all with me? There is such a thing as transcendent femininity and masculinity, then what we would call freedom of development is limited by and restricted to reality, that is, our natures. And a woman, it, just exactly like a man, who is in conformity with reality, which is to say in conformity with the will of God, they will find perfect development and freedom just as men will. Each by observing the restrictions that are built into reality. And the man who tries to break out of it will destroy himself just like the woman. And in this male-female relationship we call marriage, when masculinity interfaces with proper femininity, you get maturity and completeness in which neither party feels deprived. That is, you say, well, a woman resents being in subjection to a husband. Well, a man resents being responsible for the home. We all tend to resent that which limits our freedom. And a lot of men, they resent being responsible, so what do? They give the kids to the wife and they leave. That happens every day. Just pull out. Goodbye. I was born to roam, and I'm going to roam. Goodbye. See the kids on weekends. See? And women are doing that. I hope I'm making this clear. The problem is not a woman's, a female problem. The problem is a human problem. And the problem is, and it's a spiritual problem that's creating this, that women don't want to be in subjection to their husbands. And I've met some of their husbands. I wouldn't want to be in subjection to them either. Women don't want to be in subjection to their husbands, and men don't want to go to the cross. It's not a female problem, it's a human problem. It's a spiritual problem. We're going to be looking at some very practical applications of this. Any questions on what I'm trying to teach you? I feel like I'm not doing a very good job of it. Well, it means, fellas, for instance, that if you've got a temper, I'm just going to pick out a few examples to teach to drive home the principle, and we could multiply examples for the rest of the quarter. If you've got a temper, you're the typical angry father, angry husband. And I feel sorry for the person who grew up under an angry father. High percentage of fathers are angry fathers. If you're an angry father, fellas, speak to you first. You're an angry person. It's time to go to the cross. That anger is hurting your kids. Your kids are going to hate to see you come home because they don't know whether you're going to be mad or not. They're going to test the waters. How's dad? You know, is dad mad or not? Depending on whether you're going to have a good evening. And your wife bites her tongue half the time because she'd rather put up with with injustice in order to keep a little peace in the home. She's had all the racket she wants. If you're that kind of person, you do not have the right, it's time to go to the cross. You do not have the right to say, well, this is the way I am, take me or leave me. I'm the head of the house, that's the way I'm going to be. You knew that when you married me. So watch out. And men do that. They may not put it in those words, but that's exactly how they feel. You know, nobody's going to tell me I can't do this. No, it's time to nail that anger to the cross. Christ gave himself for the church. What do? Well, you get alone with God and you work on this and you pray about it and you change. Men, if you got a choice, but if you're one of these fellows who likes a new car every year, no matter what, and your family is doing without some very important things because you like that new car every year, it's time to ask God to grant you the grace of feeling good driving an old car. Time to go to the cross, put that new car on the cross. You know what I'm saying? And if your wife, and now you can get more subtle than that. This gets very painful. If your wife says to you, "Honey, I wish you'd talk to me more. We need more time together." You cannot say, "Well, that's not the way I am. I don't like to talk that much." No. What you have to do, he has to go to a wedding. Somebody's committing monogamy. What do? You see, this can get very sacred. I know a preacher. I'll tell you a story about a preacher. I know. You know, he ruined his home. He didn't ruin his home by being mean. He didn't ruin his home, his marriage, by being selfish with money. You know, he liked to read. Yeah, he read good books. And whenever any spare time, he read, and his wife did whatever she did. She would ask him, "Honey, let's come talk to me and spend some time together." But he liked to read. And he finished a lot of books, got a good education, lost his home. You see, sometimes what you have to put on the cross is not a new car or a temper, sometimes it's something very good. And that's tough. By the way, it's harder to get up the good stuff than it is that which is obviously wrong. You getting the idea? You see, redemptively, that's going to the cross is the little things. The kids, well, you come home, you're big and important, you got your three-piece suit on, or you're on your way to church or from church, and you're three kinds of hot stuff, and your little four-year-old says, "Daddy, be my horsey." What are you going to do? Well, you can't always, can you? You can't always be my horsey. But and you're busy, and you got things on your mind. You think, "Man, be a horsey. I just came from a board meeting." or I'm going to one. You go, "Oh man, I got problems. What am I going to do?" No, it's time to go to the cross sometime. Take off your coat, loosen your tie, and be a horsey. It's hard for men. You see, you get the picture? This is how you're the head of the house. You take the responsibility. Listen, men, here's what I'm teaching you, and I'm right about this. You are responsible for your wife's joy. If your wife is unhappy, you're responsible. You see, a lot of men think they're in charge of certain stuff, but their wife's in charge of something else. I know a lot of homes where the man thinks he's in charge of order and misery, and she's in charge of joy. And an angry man can take more joy out of a home in 5 minutes than a good woman can put in 5 years. Men, you're a chairman of every committee, including the joy committee. You're responsible. If your kids are happy and glad to be home when they're home, if your teenagers are not glad to be home when they know you're going to be there, you're responsible. I'm serious. Well, it kind of takes the shine off of being the head of the house, doesn't it? All of a sudden, it doesn't sound nearly like it's as much fun as it was. Frankly, I'd rather give the job to somebody else. I don't know why I was born a man. It's a heavy load to carry. I'm serious. Been married 26 years and got 4 kids. It's not easy. I don't mean to get overly personal, but You see, this swinging kind of bachelor, macho image guy who, you know, with his shirt unbuttoned, driving a red sports car, you know, swagging around, those are sissies in my opinion. You know, until they face mortgage payments and dirty diapers, they are cowards. they don't have what it takes.
You talk about, I'll tell you, you want to see a cross, the first dirty diaper, fellas. That's
Amen.
You know, it's like, here's your wife, she's been with the kid all day and she's tired. You know, she's tired, and you got a nice suit on, you come home, sit down in your dignity, and the baby crawls up on your lap, and you... What are you going to say? You're going to say, honey, come and get this kid. Or are you going to go to the cross? Yeah. And listen, I say this, I'm before the age of paper diaper. Paper diapers came in the middle of my career. I'm back in the commode with, you know. I'll tell you, that commode looks like a cross sometimes. You understand what I'm saying? Sometimes it's big things, sometimes it's little things. But we are responsible. Now women, on the other hand, they are responsible to let a man. And sometimes it takes patience, especially ladies, and I say this because I'm teaching undergraduate school. My wife taught me this. She's the smartest person I ever met. I'm serious about that, the most wise person I ever met. She said, you know what you got to do if you're going to marry young, like, you know, at college age, is you got to have the wisdom to see what a fellow, she talked to girls, you got to see what they're going to be. Because they aren't much now. pretty sorry. You understand? You got to look at what he is now and see what he's going to be. And if he's always ever going to be, go get somebody else. But listen to me. And you've got to help him learn to take his responsibility. And you don't do it by hitting him off all the time. And it's hard. A woman has to go to a cross a little bit too, some. And she has to learn to let him learn how, if he needs to learn how. It takes patience with young couples to get this all sorted out. Take my word for it. And she has to let him make his mistakes let me put it this way, ladies. He has to go to the cross himself. You can't nail him there. That didn't work. And a lot of women stand around with their hammer and nails saying, you just slip once, Charlie, and up you go. But what we have is a partnership. Is it an equal partnership? No. It is equal in love, equal in commitment, equal in sacrifice. The only area it is not equal in is responsibility. And men, most of that is ours. Ladies, let me ask you, if you had a man who would marry you with that understanding, would you have any problem with that? No, I don't think so. If you have a problem with that, then stay single. You're not a candidate for marriage. Well, that's the principle. Now, we're going to talk about other applications. Are there any questions? Okay, we'll stop there for the day.
The manner of subjection, and I was trying to teach the biblical principle as I understand it, of a male responsibility, a command for wives to submit to their husbands. It does not, let me read now, it is based on the creative order. It does not imply subjection or inferiority of the nature that will hinder the full development of either husband or wife. Development along the lines and in accord with that which God intends for man. The biblically enjoined submission is temporal, and is part of the larger concept of Christian meekness
and humility in submitting to each other. Ephesians 5:21, 1 Peter 5:5. Just briefly. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Now, we talked, before I leave this subject, we looked at it mainly from the man's point of view. That is, the operative word in the biblical doctrine that the man is the head of the house is what? What is the operative word? Responsibility. And where does man become the head of the house? On the cross. Love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. To repeat myself, it's the key principle. Now, that is the difference from the man's point of view. That is the difference between being simply a despot and the true head of the house. You see, to be the boss of the house takes very little, but to be the leader of the home takes going to a cross with a high degree of regularity. Understand? The men are the leaders in the home. Now, this does not mean that the time does not come when the man has the responsibility to, whether he speaks softly or not, to carry a big stick. That is, the time comes sometimes in most homes when a man has to simply say, this is the way, we've talked about it, thought about it, but I'm going to have to decide, and this is the way it's going to have to be. Or the man has to be the final court of appeal. I don't think it happens very often in a working home. But it happens once in a while, especially with older children. You know, a great deal of, let me just say this to you, in a home generates a great deal of energy, mental energy. And as kids get older, they've got their wills. And as these wills mature, and we want them to mature, they begin to assert themselves. And that's healthy. But the time comes when there's a clash of the wills, when you have an immature will that asserts itself beyond the proper bounds. And it's a very, very efficient thing. The head of the house, if he's a man, he's in the ideal home, then he has to simply once in a while say, look, time out. This is the way it's going to be. There are serious times when that happens, and there are fun times when that happens. The year before Leandra was married, we took our old Blue, our big van, went on one last family trip while we were an intact family. Before anybody got married, we went out west for a month. It's our journey, our sentimental journey into bankruptcy. And it was great fun every mealtime. Because at our house, everybody's a chief and we don't have any Indians for some reason. And everybody thinks they're the head of whatever world they're in. So they get together and it was great fun. Where do you want to eat? You ask that question. It was like saying, sick 'em to a pack of pit bulls. Where do you want, and you always got one person who doesn't like Mexican food, and one person who doesn't like Chinese, and one person that can't stand, my wife is the person who can't stand the fast food McDonald's. And so what do? Well, that's a fun time. And you, finally the time comes when the husband has to simply pull up to a restaurant and say, this is where we're eating, I'm buying, and anybody who wants to come is welcome. And the rest can sit in the car and make noises. Amazing how that gets everybody's attention. But there's time to compromise. What I usually, being a coward, a natural coward, what I often do is I'd find where you have a steakhouse next to a Burger King. You know, I'd pull up and say, okay, here's your money. Everybody can go where they want to go. And we've had them in as many as three restaurants at one time, I think. But there are serious times when that happens. What I'm saying is, when we say that the man becomes the head of the house on the cross, we are not saying that he ceases to be an authority figure. Jesus certainly is the Lord of the church, is he not? And there has to be that final court of appeals. Now listen, if every case
is appealed to the Supreme Court every day, something's wrong. But there has to be those times when he has to say, in effect, look, I'm going to get this straightened out. It's my responsibility. I'm going to spank everybody that gets in my way, so watch out. And, you know, there have been times when I grounded all the kids, two of the neighbors, and the dog. Well, that's a little extreme, but that those times come. And, they will come. On the other hand, that's the man's point of view. We'll come back to those we talked about in various particulars. From the woman's point of view, what does subjection mean? Does it mean that she's a second-class citizen? If it does, then it's his fault. And if, fellas, if you have made a second-class citizen out of your wife, God will hold you responsible for that. You see, if a man thinks, now listen to me, fellas, if a man thinks that the biblical teaching that we're talking about gives him the right to degrade his wife, to detract from her dignity, her personal dignity, then he has misunderstood the text and he has not learned how to apply it. That is, let me make this as specific as I can, and you ask me questions, you don't understand. It's a delicate balance. And even in the best of homes, it gets overbalanced one way or the other sometimes. It is one thing for a man to say, well now, I'm the head of the house, and which he should never say that, but you know, my response, I'm going to decide how the money is going to be spent, and this is how it's going to be spent. That's not the biblical way. The biblical way is for a man and his wife to be a team, to work things out, to agree, and only in cases of where you get to a point of disagreement and he feels like that he has to take responsibility for it. But that shouldn't happen very often. Shouldn't happen almost never. And as you marry, and as a couple learns how to live together and you have mutual respect, then things work better. Let me teach you something, students. If you're not married, don't marry somebody you cannot respect. Will somebody close those? My eyes are suffering from that. Those windows. Don't marry somebody you cannot respect. You see, you can be crazy about somebody and not really respect them. In a kind of, you can have a crush on somebody. You see, when you marry, make sure you marry a person. I talked about this before. Marry a person. There's something there you can respect as a person, not as an object of romance, not simply as a sex partner, but as a person. And no arrangement, whether I don't care who's the head of the house or who tries to be or who thinks he or she is, if there is not mutual respect, it isn't going to work. You got that? It is not going to work. If there is mutual respect, then this matter of who's the head of the house and who is not will work out of respect. That is, a man will respect his wife too much to degrade her. He will elevate her. And a woman will respect her husband too much to bait him and degrade him. Now, and this is a very delicate thing because you can lose respect very easily. It takes a long time to get it back. You can get it back, but it takes a while to get it back, and you have to earn respect. Is that right? And the husband is to respect his wife. The woman is, this is a biblical teaching, to respect her husband. Now, I don't do a very good. So a wife, it does not mean that she has no voice. It does not mean that she's not an equal partner in the sense that her ideas are as important as his. It simply means that he bears the final responsibility and has the final authority. And most women want it that way. Can you think of any situations where it might be difficult to follow the biblical mandate? And I don't want to get into a lot of personal histories or anything, but does this raise some questions in your mind that we need to answer? This that would be helpful to discuss in class, especially from the ladies. From the lady. Yes. What as a minister? What advice do you give to a woman whose husband beats up on her regularly? The advice is move out. Why? Because he can kill you. And I don't care how sorry he is the next day and what kind of promises he makes until you get help, I'm living somewhere else. Because a lot of women are severely damaged. I recall a case when I was a local man. We had a guy who was a mean drunk. He's a nice guy and he's sober, but he'd get drunk and he got mean. And he had a lovely wife. And he wasn't a bad guy overall. But boy, one night he took an aluminum ball bat to her and came that close to killing her. And I helped the law find him for her sake and for his sake. And, but she kept forgiving him. The next day he'd be a mean drunk on Friday nights, a crying drunk on Saturday morning with a headache. And she'd forget him. He'd beg and plead. By Tuesday things were pretty well patched up, and on Friday he was at it again. So that was a very clear situation. That's an extreme situation. But most situations aren't like that. They're less extreme. Let me give you an example where this is very practical. Suppose a man, he has a career, and his job requires him to move to the next state. And his wife says, well, you got no right to ask me to move away from my mother. I like to live in the same town with mommy. I'm not going to do it. Just find another job. There's a woman who needs to be taken to the woodshed. in one way or the other. I don't mean physically. I mean, why? There's a woman who's never... She's never left her father and mother and gone with her husband. But that can go too far to the extreme. I know men who get so jealous of his wife's parents. They won't let them call them, won't let them go see them. You're my wife now. And you see, it's a delicate balance. But there's a woman who needs to, and I think he needs to say to her, look, honey, this is my job, and this is for the best of our family, and it's in my best judgment, we've talked about it, this is the way it has to be, start packing. And she says, well, you go by yourself. I think she's going to answer to God. You understand? And this is why. Because if the woman's place, if you married the man, your place is with him. You should have made that, if you were going to be the kind of person who wouldn't go with him, you should have married somebody else. Here's the rule, ladies. If you cannot respect him and be in subjection to him, don't marry him. He's not that kind of man. Don't marry him.
What do you counsel a woman who's already married that she can't?
Don't have much to say. It's one of the reasons I'm into prevention and not cure, because usually there isn't any cure. It's very difficult. Problem with, do you understand what he asked? He's got a man that won't treat her right, and what does she do? See, the problem with marriage, the problem with dealing with, the thing then with marriage problems is, you got two people involved. And you can talk to one and get one person straightened out. It doesn't help the situation. What about the other one? Unless you can get him to change, not much he can do. The answer is do the best you can. Respect him as far as you can. A lot of women get in trouble. They get into extramarital affairs because they don't respect the man they're married. And a man, in my opinion, one of the biggest oafs, one of the biggest duds in the world is a man who says to his wife, "Look, I'm your husband. You got to respect me whether you want to or not." Well, that's absurd. You understand? Respect is like love. You cannot require it. You cannot drop a contract and say, okay, you owe me this respect. Listen, she may owe you the respect, man, but then you can claim that from now until the cows come home, but if you have not earned it, you're not going to get it. She may not tell you you're not going to get it, but you've got to earn. Respect has to be earned. And listen, respect is earned in little things, not big dramatic things. Is he a coward? Is he a hard worker? Does he keep his word? Is he responsible? For instance, let me give you a clear case. This happens. There's a woman and this happens a lot. Here's a woman who's trying to feed the kids and keep meals on the table and buy clothes and pay the PTA dues. And her husband is always going out and buying things on an installment plan that he can't afford. And there's never enough money to run the family. What does she do? And just about the time they get paid up, you know, where they begin to have enough money for the house, he goes out and buys another boat for $12,000, and right back where they started. How can she respect a man like that? She has to suffer, kids have to suffer, he's got his boat. You know, and that kind of thing happens regularly. There's a man, he's lost respect. Sometimes she'll say, "Honey, let's eat out." And he's going to have to say, "Honey, we ate out last week, and I got some bills due. If we eat out, it's going to be McDonald's. Let's stay home tonight." Now she can do one of two things. She can pout and say, "I've been in the house all week with these kids, and I don't care what the money is. I deserve to be taken out for a big dinner." Then I think she needs to be taken to the woodshed. By that, he needs to say, "Honey, back off. I can't afford it, and this is the way it's going to be." And most women are glad a man is responsible like that. I think they're glad a man will say, "Look, honey, it's a good idea. I wish we could, but not this week. Car payment's due. I'll make a date for you a week from Friday." Most reasonable women would say, "Okay, that's good enough." But not some women won't. You know, I don't care. A lot of women keep their husbands head over heels in debt. They get a credit card and they go crazy. And just petulant, spoiled, you know. Fellas, if she's a spoiled brat, she may have the cutest little backdoor swing you can possibly imagine. But if she's a spoiled brat, don't marry her. I'm serious. Why? Because you know what little spoiled brats grew up to be?
Big
spoiled brats. Now, and this passes from one generation to the next. I recall I made a big hit with my son-in-law. My son-in-law is a Marine Corps pilot, and this is their first year. They're married this is the early years of their marriage, and he has to be sent, I think, to Okinawa for 6 months. And the decision came to be that they were trying to decide whether LeAngelo was going to go with him or not. She had a job, and it would be best if she went or stayed home, and she was thinking about coming living with us for the 6 months, which she's not going to do. But, you know, well, the real temptation was, you know, and so she called up and said, "Daddy, what should I do?" And, you know, big temptation was to say, "Okinawa is bad news. Come home, be with Daddy for 6 months." I would have loved to have said that, but I didn't. Look, you married him, your place is with your husband. And as it turns out, I think she's going to go neither place. They're going to work it out. She's going to make some trips back and forth. But the point is, you understand, my that's what I teach my kid. Look, you marry him, that's your husband, you pay respect to him, you're with him. I've known parents that would say, "Oh, honey, surely he's not going to..." Here's some mothers would say this, "Oh, darling, surely he's not going to be such a meanie as to make you go to that godforsaken place where they don't even have a decent shopping center and live in those stark, bare, hot, you know, the base housing for half a year. Surely he's not going to do that." You know? My father-in-law taught me that, as well as my parents. And my father-in-law said, "You marry him, you live with him. And you respect him and you honor him because you married him." Any other questions? I'm probably not putting the right tone on this. It's not a biblical balance between, now to me and students, a biblical balance between authority and subjection is a beautiful thing. It is not ugly. It is not irksome. It is not a daily issue. It is not unfair. That is, most women want a man who will take it as his personal, take it as his immediate personal responsibility that she is happy. If he says to her, honey, are you, every day he says, honey, are you broke? Need some money? If he says, you know, if he picks up the milk on the way home when he knows you're out of milk, you got teenage boys who drink 40 gallons a week. If he says, look, what, you know, I want to go to, she says, I want to go to the beach today. And he can say, again? You know, spent all that money with there just last week. Or he can say, honey, I'm glad to hear that. You need that. Hope you have a good time. Here, take the credit card in case you run out of money. Have a good time. Now, I'm not making this up. And he said, I got a little kid. And he says, I'm home tonight. Why don't you go visit your sister? Why don't you and your sister go to a movie? Let me watch the kids tonight. I've been wanting to spend some time with them anyway. Or come Saturday and you say, and you got toddlers running around, you say, honey, why don't you go to the shopping center and mess around, do what you want to do, I'll take the kids with me. You understand? Make yourself responsible for her happiness. And if she says, I don't like keeping the checkbook, I don't feel like paying the bills, you know, it's always on my mind, I'm worried about it. He says, okay, it's my responsibility, if you don't want to, I'll take it. We're worried about it. You know, if that's what she would, make himself responsible, little things like that. It's an attitude, you understand? It's an attitude where he says, honey, are you happy? Are you okay? Do you have what you need? Can I help you? And where would you like to go? Friday night. Call her up from work and say, honey, I know you've had a hard week. So we'll go to Morrison's tonight. Forget supper. When he can afford it. You see? Okay, and so he has this general attitude. And listen, even if no money is involved, these things sound like material. I'm trying to teach you guys something. It's a matter of an attitude, of a spirit. Then when the time comes, when you have to say, honey, I hear what you're saying, but I'm going to have to say no. Then she'll take it. Why? Because you know she knows, even if she doesn't agree with you, and that won't happen very often, she knows that you love her and you have your best interest. You're not out to get her. You've got her best interest at heart. Now listen to me. A woman will trade. If a woman has a man who will take the burden of ultimate responsibility in the home. You got that? That is his, no matter who earns the money, he takes the ultimate responsibility to see that. Let me show you what I'm talking about. He says, by the ultimate responsibility, he makes sure you've got a decent place to live. No matter who, he takes the responsibility. If something goes wrong, he takes the ultimate responsibility for something. He doesn't say to his wife, here, I can't do anything about it, do your best. He makes sure that there's enough life insurance so that if he's gone, his wife will not be left trying to raise two kids, you know, with a fourth of the income or half the income she had before. She won't have to go live with her parents. You know, ultimate responsibility. And he sees there's a retirement. He sees that there's hospitalization if he can. In other words, he sees that there's this backup system, you know, that she's not going to have to worry every day that something goes wrong and everything falls apart. It's a general philosophy. And if a woman has a man, I think most women, who will take that kind of ultimate responsibility, honey, are you okay? You know, I'm going away for the weekend. You got enough money? Here. Oh yeah, let me give you some more. Well, you don't, this conversation, she'll say, okay, honey, you got enough money? I've been gone for 3 days. Oh yeah, I got enough. Well, you better take this. Well, you don't need it. No, I don't need it. They'll feed me on the plane. So here you said, you take it. That's a whole lot better than, you know, trying to sneak out of the house and hope she doesn't raise the issue. Am I teaching you something? It's a philosophy. Okay, a woman who has this ultimate responsibility taken from her, which most women don't want, are going to feel that it's a small price to pay to have a man who will sometimes lovingly say, I'm sorry, but this is the way it's going to be. Does that make sense to you? Ladies, you agree with that? I'm a man speaking this. What do you say? Do you have anything to say about it? Comments?
Men, I'm telling you, these boys need to hear this. They need to hear what you've got to say. Especially this outfit over here. If you grew up in a home like that, you've got a head start. If you had a father who operated like that, then you've got it. But if you didn't, you got to learn it. All right, yeah. Well, but I guess that's why it's a good point, Scotty. But the point is not, if you don't do it when you don't have the money, you're not going to do it when you do. And it's not a matter of money. It's a matter of with what you have. You operate that for a lot within what you have. Yeah, and you can't always do that. You can't always have all the insurance you need. You can't always, have everything. But you have to do the best you can.
My wife's waiting for her graduate. Now she's going to me and say, now there's no excuses to take me out
to eat. Yeah, right. Well.
You know, I don't think for rural that you have to take them out to make them out all the time.
No.
It's just good work for them to know that the man cares enough about them that they can go out and, go for a walk.
How you doing? How days you have? How you doing? And pardon?
Take
them on. Thank you, Jeff. Yeah. Well, let's get back. I got this citation from Clement. I give you the source there. Clement recognized that women are equal to men in everything, but different in vocation and function. To be a mother and a housewife is not to be a drudge or a drone. In God's sight, there can be no higher calling. That's a very important thing to say. Ambrose, who believed that the two sexes were complementary, admonished husbands not to dominate their wives. He said, "Let a husband guide his wife like a director. Honor her as a partner in his life. Share with her as a joint heir of grace." That's good, isn't it? Old, but it's good. A more modern source says, "The obedience demanded of the wife, however, was based on the underlying theological conceptions in which human relationships were interpreted in terms of God's relationship with man. Thus, for the Christian, obedience was the supreme virtue, when freely given, not from weakness, but from strength, as exemplified in Christ, wherein was manifested the highest love." Now, well, this is one of the most important things we're going to study, and I want to make sure that you have answered any questions you want to raise in this. Yep.
With the advent of the two-job family, more and more today, something that I ran across when I was about to him, and I'm running across it with now even in ministry and talking to people, is the attitude that many men seem to have, and I didn't think it was that rampant, that the woman can work, but she better not make any more money than I do. And they feel so threatened by that. I saw basically with IBM, I would see women that just turned down promotions, because if they were to get a promotion, they wouldn't be working over their husband. Maybe the husband was a farmer, and he knew how much he brought in if she worked for IBM, and if she made more money. Well, no. We're seeing that even more today.
That's
illogical to me. I can't do it.
That's an excellent point. When I had the family seminar up in Indiana a couple of 3 weeks ago, somebody came to me and raised this very point. That is, he said, "Isn't it true that the fact that more women are working out of the home and making pretty good money, so they become independent?" You see, money, I'll say two things about that. It takes a great deal of self-confidence and security in a man not to feel uncomfortable if his wife is the primary breadwinner. Secondly,
I'm not, it takes a great deal of, as I say, because men tend to feel that way. Second, many women, because money plays the role it does in our lives, it's a lever, it's a sign of power and rank. Very often, what this man said was true. A woman will think, well, since I am bringing home the bacon too, I'm also bringing home an income, whether it's equal to my husband's or not, then I don't have to play the traditional role. Now, if that happens, then that shows that that does not create, in my opinion, a problem, the problem, but it gives, it makes the problem come to the surface. That is, if a husband and wife are having a problem in this matter that we're talking about, and she goes out and gets it, you know, anyway, and she goes out and gets a job and starts bringing home a good income, and she says, well, that's the end of subjection, then the paycheck has just brought it to the surface. That's my opinion. But the effect is the same. Now, the solution for that is a genuine partnership. Whenever I see a home where it's your money and my money, I am afraid for that home, no matter who brings it in. Where he says, my paycheck, I'll do what I want with it. The man says that, his home probably isn't going to work. That betrays an attitude which is so fundamentally defective, it's so far removed from the biblical model, that he's in for trouble. Or if now some men do this. I know one man, he was so insecure, his plan was that they lived off of his income, and she could do whatever she wanted to with hers, but he would not use her income for mortgage and groceries. Why? His ego couldn't take it. So she had his money, she'd just play with it wherever she wanted, but you know, and often they needed things. You know, things they really needed. He wouldn't let her buy them. Things for the house. Why? Because, you know, if we're going to live off of my money, and if you make an income, I just, well, that's, there's a little man with a delicate ego trying to feel like a man when he wasn't. Yes?
That wouldn't be necessarily wrong if they can live off of his salary and then put hers away or something and kind of work. You know, get some extra things that they wanted to get.
But that's not what I'm talking about. He would not buy anything for the house because he wasn't going to have anything in that house that he didn't buy. Otherwise, he would feel like he wasn't the head of the house. Well, that's very silly. That's extreme. I'm not making that up. That's just how he felt about it. So it's a particular problem for a woman. Women today have a big problem in this for two reasons. I'll get your questions in a minute, Mark. First of all, and I'm glad you brought this up. First of all, our culture says to the woman, you're in subjection to nobody. And we hear that. Little girls are raised to think that way. The second is, it's harder and harder for women today to find men to marry that they can respect. And you got lucky, didn't you? Because and that is culture too. You see, that is a cultural thing too. You see, I'm gonna give you a word that you don't. It used to be. This is a common word now. A word that used to be a part of the vocabulary. The word honor. You don't hear that word anymore. Honor. Why? Well, ours is a disintegrating culture, and honor, that kind of virtue, is medieval. Who's honored? Who is honored today? Well, the guy who can pull the fanciest tricks and makes the most money, and he's the winner. What about honor? What about? So, see what I'm saying? That it's hard for women, and it's hard for men to know how to be a biblical leader in a home without being bossy, about being a despot. And it's hard for a man to find a woman who will be in subjection to him. I know a man who is used to a wife treating him with respect and who has treated her with respect, he finds it very difficult when somebody else's wife gets real mouthy over something. He finds it very difficult to take that. I told a woman one time, I said, look, I don't want to offend you, but I don't let my own wife talk to me that way. I'm sure not going to let you. I don't know what I've done if she'd have kept it up, but
take her out to the woodshed.
At least I bluffed her. Later, when we talk about time, but it's an excellent question, and she understands what she's asking. She's ready. Let me say this about it here, and we'll come at it from a different angle later on, say more about it. But if, what you say that is the man, if he's got children, it's his responsibility to provide so that she will not have to work, so she can be there raising. That is the ideal. You're exactly right. That is the ideal. Now. And the principle what I teach is this, Lori, where it is possible, I believe that wisdom dictates and biblical principles strongly suggest that if you're going to have kids, that she needs this gentleman to bring them up, be there with them. Where it is possible. Now, in some situations, it's simply not possible. And I'm very sympathetic to that. That's somebody going to school, for instance. You don't make much. You can't make much money going to college, you see. And they're where it is possible. Now, you understand? The question is, what is possible? I'll give you an example. I think that if it's possible, I'm saying it is so desirable. It is so desirable that if it is necessary to cut back the standard of living for a few years, I recommend that. It's better to have fewer things and live in a smaller house and have an intact home where the children have a mother all the time than it is to have a bigger house and more things, if that's the choice. And I strongly teach that. And we practice this in our home. So I have a right to say that. Fortunately, that was her choice. That was her thinking. Now, she works part-time now and has for the last 2 years, but just three mornings a week. And all the time our kids were little, she never worked. That she did. She was busy and all that thing. She did not insist on new furniture, new bedroom suit, you know, all this stuff. And the woman has to be willing to do it. In other words, if she had to choose, if you just said to her, look, we can afford this new furniture if you'll go out and get a job, she'd have laughed at that. We'll get by on furniture, things like that, the extra things. But my place is here for children. And that's our family. Now, it's not quite that simple. There are some women, to try to be fair now, you understand what I'm teaching? Now, sometimes even with cutting back, it's not possible. And it might be possible sometime in the life and not another. Well, the hard thing to do, one of the real dangers, by the way, of a woman getting a job is you raise your standard of young couples, they'll get married, and they're both working because they're both single. And they have a pretty good income, and then a child comes along. Are they willing to cut their income? It's hard to move backwards, your standard of living. It's hard to cut it back. But I see many who do it.
I've seen a couple who sold a car, you know, and they said, we're going to cut back now. Or they would plan it. That we're not going to. Well, I've seen couples say, we're going to buy some of these things now. My wife's working, and we're going to make sure they're paid for so that the year after next, when we start our family, my wife can quit. I like that. You see, they're planning ahead. There are many ways around this.
Isn't that one of the major keys, though, is the planning? Because if you're, and of course, the situation where the man gets laid off and has to take a lesser job, there's nothing that can be done about that. But to sit there and say, okay, I have this type of job, so the type of work that I am, I know what my salary is going to be, and I'm going to start knocking off kids one after the other, and then all of a sudden you get the debts like she's talking about. That's just poor planning, not good stewardship of your time. Or
when you're talking about the two incomes when they first married, I had a girlfriend that they were in that situation, and then when the children started coming, she quit work for a while, and they adapted to the lesser salary. She was so used to being in the workforce that she wanted to go back to work. When they put their children in childcare, her entire salary went for the daycare. So they were better off not even with her work anyway. And I think a lot of times that was willing to pay.
What she's saying is, and she would deny it if you put it to her, I'm going to have the kind of life I want. I'll let my kids pay for it. Let the little kids pay for it. If you ever work in child care, you see, especially when the child first goes into child care, the genuine suffering when their parents leave them. Those kids suffer. And sometimes it's inevitable. You understand? I realize that. My rule is, if you can. Now, it's not fair, it's not right, like you say, or to expand on what Daryl's saying, it's not right for a couple to get themselves so deep in debt for things they don't really need, so that there's no choice. And they say, well, I don't have any choice. Yes, but you don't have a choice now, but you had a choice back then. That's when you should have made the
choice. Other ways to ask for even arrangements so that you, even if you can't, like my parents, there was no way that only one of them could work. They both had to work when they had children, but my mom had arranged so that I was the oldest, so I was in school, and she was the school secretary, so I went to the school she worked at. And my sister stayed and my mother stayed at a lady's house, and the lady was right across the street.
Yes, it's not, I was going to say, it gets complicated, and there are many arrangements. It's not as simple as I've stated it's simple, the bare principle. Now, you go beyond that, there are variations of it. For instance, it's one thing to work when the children are at home, 3 and 4 years old. That's bad. It's something else when they go to school, if you're there when they get home. That's a different situation. It's not desirable, though. That's not always the best. For instance, you ask any school teacher, they got a real problem with kids when they get sick and there's nobody at home. And listen to me. I know this because we've raised four kids, and I'm right about this. Those kids, when they're younger, even when they get, and not all that young, they like to know, even while they're at school, that mommy's at home there, and if anything happens, home is there. That if they went home and threw up, that backup is there. They don't feel like they're on the end of a limb. They don't. What am I going to do if this happens? They like to know they're there, even if they don't need to be there. What I'm trying to teach you is there are reasons why the ideal cannot be practiced. But brother, if you don't practice the ideal, make sure the reason is legitimate. Make sure you got a good reason. And it takes planning sometimes. Yes?
This may be a strange question, but is there ever time when daycare is better for a child to
get home? Good question. Is there ever a time when daycare is better? And I think there are cases, extreme cases, where the mother is such a lousy parent. You see, we've assumed that the time is going to be now. That's a very extreme case. Even a lousy parent at home is better than a daycare. But if you get a super lousy parent, some kids are better. And that'd be the only case I can think of. Or if they're in a neighborhood or a situation where they would feel destructive, there are extreme cases. So the answer to your question is yes, but not normally.
Well, we would maybe point off what she was saying. There would be times when a lot of daycare centers now are offering partial daycare or Tuesdays and Thursdays in the morning for kids that, as they get older, second, two, three, 4 years old, to start learning some social, especially old, single kids, one family kids, where they can go ahead and learn social values for their kids.
Well,
if they're not getting that somewhere else.
Hopefully they'll
be getting that at church or in nursery school.
That's right. Very delicate. And what about a... And again, we're talking about whether it's a husband and a wife. What about if it's a single parent? You see, there are cases where you just have no choice. But I think we understand my answer to the principle. And listen, it's easy to talk about, but the time comes when your friends are getting the new cars, and you got to decide: Are we gonna get by? You know, and so we can have these kids.